Exodus chapter 19 this morning. Exodus chapter 19. Entitled the message this morning, Prepare to Meet Thy Maker. Usually we think of that in a terminal setting. Somebody gets ready to sign off and breathe their last on this planet. Prepare to meet our Maker. But that's literally what Israel is about to do as they enter into this portion of the story, as they enter into this event this morning. They're getting ready to meet with God. It's an amazing thing when you stop and think about it, that man can meet with God. Exodus 19, beginning in verse 7, the Bible says, So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered together and said, All that the Lord has spoken, we will do. Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, Behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with you, may also believe you forever. When Moses told the words of the people to the Lord said to Moses, Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Let them wash their garments and be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set limits for the people all around, saying, Take care not to go up into the mountain or touch the edge of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. No hand shall touch him. He shall be stoned or shot. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people, and they washed their garments. And he said to the people, Be ready for the third day, and do not go near a woman. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God. And they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on top of it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in a thunder, or literally in a voice. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain. And the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord said to Moses, Go down and warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to look, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. And Moses said to the Lord, The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you yourself warned us, saying, Set limits around the mountain and consecrate it. The Lord said to him, Go down and come up, bringing Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and told them.
I'm not what you would call the world's greatest hunter. I've gotten one deer in my life. It was a little bigger than a German shepherd, maybe not quite that big. It was a pretty small one. But it was the only one that I got. But I remember getting ready for going out and going deer hunting. We went out to my grandpa's farm out in western Minnesota, and it'd be just the guys. And then we would go up about an hour north of his house to some state game lands, and that's where we'd spend our time looking for these little critters as they'd walk through the forest. And it was cold about that time of year. It was probably down in the 20s, maybe in the teens at night. I remember bringing my snowsuit because there's snow on the ground in hunting season in Minnesota anyway. So we'd go out to my grandfather's farmhouse, and the night before, we'd get everything ready. We would pack the sandwiches. We'd make sure the coffee's ready. We'd take a couple different thermoses with us, so we'd have a couple different pots ready to go. And we'd go upstairs, and upstairs of their farmhouse wasn't heated. So upstairs at night, it would stay about 40 degrees or so. And We'd put on half of our layers of clothing that we were going to wear out in the morning so that we would be ready. All we have to do is get in our snowsuit and run out and grab the coffee on the way out. We made sure that we had the guns. We made sure we had the ammunition. We made sure that we had something to sit on so that your backside didn't get cold as you're sitting there on the ground in the snow. We made sure we had everything. So you're staying up at night getting everything ready for the hunt in the morning, and you're staying up later, you're staying up just a little later, you're staying up a little later, and finally that 4 o'clock alarm goes off and you get ready and you grab everything and you go out the door. I remember getting at that point. My grandpa was a very kind man, but he wasn't a very patient man, especially at 4:30 in the morning. And he said, come on, we gotta get going now. So, all right. I thought we had everything ready last night. We didn't quite have it ready. But you stay up late at night because you're getting stuff ready, because the next day there's an event that you're planning for. Remember when I was a youth pastor, we would do missions trips. And I remember the weekend that Kimberly was born. I had 2 missions trips. I had to get everything ready. And so we had a gymnasium that I had 2 separate piles of stuff. We were leading VBSs in both locations. And so for the week that Kimberly was due, and she was due any day, in fact, she was 10 days overdue, but for that whole week, I'm getting everything ready, laying everything out, counting out slips of paper, counting out games, and getting everything ready for 2 separate groups. Finally, Kimberly's born. We bring her home from the hospital. I literally drop her off on the doorstep, turn around and run down to church where the vans are loaded, and we head off to Nova Scotia for these missions trips. I remember how intense it was preparing for that moment of getting ready for the event. And when that clock ticks, that day turns, all of a sudden you're ready. This morning we jumped everything ahead. So last night you were getting everything ready, making sure all the clocks were set, making sure all the clothes were ready so that this morning we could make the event. When we come to the prospect of the event that we call church, of coming together to meet with God, I wonder how much preparation you've put into it as we've come to this day. Think through yesterday. What did you do to prepare for meeting with God today? How did you get your soul ready? How did you get your body ready? How did you get yourself ready for this event called meeting with God? A lady named Annie Dillard writes a book called Teaching a Stone to Talk. She worries that we have perhaps forgotten how dangerous it is to come into the presence of the living God. She writes, "On the whole, I do not find Christians outside the catacombs sufficiently sensible of the conditions. Does anyone have the foggiest idea what sort of a power we so blithely invoke? Or, as I suspect, does no one believe a word of it? The churches are children playing on the floor with their chemistry sets, mixing up a batch of TNT to kill a Sunday morning. It is madness to wear ladies' straw hats and velvet hats to church. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews." When you stop and think about what it is that we're actually doing right now, we've come together to meet with God. As the church moves through its history, there's different times, different places where different aspects of God are kept before us. At times, we understand more and better of God's transcendence, that God is high and lifted up, that He transcends, that He's bigger than He's outside of. And as we come to this God of transcendence, there's with a sense of holy awe, of reverence. On the other side of the coin, there's the more imminent God that is more approachable. He's the one who's what a friend we have in Jesus. He's the Abba, Father. And it seems different times in different places, in different regions even sometimes, there's a swing of the pendulum where God is either seen as austere and distant, and times when God's seen more as a buddy. And I think if we would be honest with ourselves, we're probably on this end of the spectrum at this point, with an imminent God who's more our buddy that we casually come to as a friend. As God brings His people to this moment, He sets Himself up in such a way that He brings them to this physical mount, Mount Sinai, which is lifted up from the desert floor some 8,000 feet. It's an impressive sight. You can't miss it. Obviously, there's room there on that plain for many thousands of people to be able to gather, and that's exactly what they do. As God ushers them to this place, walks them for 3 months in the desert, and finally arrives here, He said back in the previous verses that the reason I've been doing this is to draw you to Myself, to bring you to Myself. So we've done that. And as He begins to bring them to this place, they're setting up camp. Moses goes up on top of this mountain, and God says, I want you to go down to the people and tell them who they are, that they're a kingdom of priests, that they're a holy nation, that they're going to dwell in the midst of the nations as one who stands between Me and the peoples, representing Me to the peoples and representing the peoples unto Me. Because by you all nations on earth will be blessed. I want you to understand who you are. Moses says, okay, this is what we'll do. In verse 7, we find Moses coming and calling the elders of the people and setting before them all the words that God had commanded him to speak. Because everything I do hinges upon everything that I'm called to be. A people of God. Now, as we move to this mountain, a mountain that is going to be shrouded with smoke, with lightnings, with thunders. We're going to see that as the people gather here, that they're energized, they're empowered with a tremendously powerful view of their God. One of the things that happens in the transition from seeing God as big, as robust, as high and lifted up, and transitioning over on the other side to seeing Him as approachable, as friendly, as the one with whom I'm acquainted, familiar. On the one side, if we don't keep this tension in place, because God is both. God is both transcendent and immanent, immanent and transcendent. He's far, He's high, and He's close. He's near. He's Emmanuel. He's God with us. He's the Holy Spirit who dwells inside of us. But one of the things that happens as we swing this pendulum back and forth, and sometimes it's not just a culture, sometimes it's just us ourselves in our experience of God. Sometimes as we swing this pendulum back and forth, we lose sight of this big God. And in our closeness to God, we sometimes lose sight of this power, this largeness of our God. As God calls His people to this place at this time, He's going to spend a lot of time setting up the fact that He's big, that He's distant, that He's unapproachable, that He's holy, that He's set apart. And it's going to be this foundation, first and foremost, that is going to be the basis of their ability later on to come near, to draw near, to be accepted by this God. But first and foremost, this God is big. And this big and powerful God brings them to this point in order to impress upon them His largeness, His bigness, His powerfulness. Because our view of God actually determines how we live for God. And the people of God are powered by a powerful view of God. You will live out your view of God. Believe it or not, you will live your theology out. I was on the phone with a pastor this past week, and we were talking through doctrine and philosophy of ministry and how you can be saying the same things but going different directions, and how sometimes in ministry, especially if you're yoked up with another pastor who's you're not quite on the same page, you're trying to work through what does my doctrine say and how is that being lived out and where are these tensions finding evidence? Because you will live out the theology that you honestly believe. And that's what God's getting at with his people. And he's driving home to them that you must have a very large view of your very large God, because you are a very special people with a very large purpose. As we work through this text, I think we're going to see there's four truths that emerge from this magnificent meeting. And it is magnificent. I don't use that lightly. This is huge. This is big. This is meant to be big on purpose. I think the first thing that we'll see in verses 7 through 9 is that God is not impressed with the words of a people who remain unimpressed with the living God. So God says, Moses, come up here, we need to talk. They're all setting up camp. Moses goes up, talks with God. God says, listen, Moses, I've got a message for my people. I want them to understand that I'm the one who brought them out of Egypt. I've carried them like a mother eagle swoops under her chicklets and brings them to safety. Okay? I've been near. I've been close. I've drawn them close unto myself. I want them to understand in verse 4, verse 5, that if they obey my voice, they will be my segula. They will be my treasured possession. They will be that thing that I delight in. They will be to me an entire kingdom of those who can approach me, of those who represent me. In the midst of all the peoples, they will be a people who is distinct because I am distinctly theirs and they are distinctly mine. But you see what it says there in verse 5. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey, and if you will indeed keep covenant, then you will be able to live out my purpose that I have for you. But it's contingent upon your keeping covenant and your being obedient. So Moses brings this message back down to the people. He says, folks, this is what God has in store and God has in mind for you. The people get excited. Anybody likes that. Hey, you know what? I see God has something special in store for your life. Who wouldn't want to be told that? Moses comes down off the mountain, and he kind of puts his arm around the shoulders of the nation, says, God has something special just for you. Yeah. So verse 7, he tells them these words. In verse 8, all the people answer together and said, everything God says, we're going to do. It's like going to camp, you get excited, you hear the message, and who wants to follow God? Yeah, me. Everybody wants to follow God. Okay, if you really want to follow God, walk the aisle. And everybody leaves their pews and everybody's down front and everybody's crying and everybody's praying. And 3 weeks later, what happens? I'm not walking to the front of an aisle again. No way. This following God stuff, that's a little tough. Maybe it's you that's made that trek down the aisle. I know I have. You go down the aisle, God, I'm going to live for you. How does that go? It goes good for a while, doesn't it? But our while is always, it doesn't matter how long it is, it always comes to an end, doesn't it? Because at some point, we just can't do it. We can't do it in our own strength. So Moses brings this message back to God. At the end of verse 8, Moses reports the words of the people to the Lord. He brings it back to God. God, they're in agreement. They want to be your treasured possession. They want to be your holy people. They want to be a kingdom of priests in the midst of the nation. They're going to do it. They're going to obey you, and they're going to keep your covenant. You can just see God kind of smiling at this point. He knows the rest of the story. He knows that in just some centuries, he's going to have to send them out of their promised land, the one that they haven't even won yet, and he's going to have to send them off into captivity to discipline them and bring their hearts back to him again. He understands that at some point in the future, he's going to have to send his son because there's no way in this world that these people can do what they've said they're going to do. But the reason that they can't do it is because throughout their history, there's going to be one thing that happens. They're going to lose a large sight of their God. You know what? It's not so unique to the people of Israel. All of us have this problem. All of us lose sight of the largeness of our God. It's the only way that we can stoop to turn against Him. It's the only way that our hearts can fall in love with anything other than Him, is when we have a smaller view of our God than that which is His due. And so the people say, "Yes, count me in." God's not impressed with the words of people who are unimpressed with their God. And we know that they're unimpressed with their God up to this point. Because for some months, God had sent them a beautiful message, a message of deliverance, a message of salvation, a message of purpose. And then He had been methodically, miraculously working on their behalf, drawing a distinction between them and the Egyptians, giving light when He sent darkness, giving comfort when He sent scabs and sores, giving life when He sent death. And throughout it all, God had been hedging them in and building them up, while the others He had been tearing down and weeding them out. He brought them to the Red Sea, and through that Red Sea, He carves a path upon which they all walk through on dry ground. He's leading them by day in a pillar of cloud, of smoke. He's leading them at night with a pillar of fire that lights up the entire encampment. Talk about a nightlight. This is absolutely fascinating. And when they're in trouble, it moves around behind them and hedges them in. What a tremendous God. But 3 days after that Red Sea event, they're out in the desert and their bellies are starting to grumble. Their tongues are starting to swell. Their voices are starting to get dry. And they start to complain. Why would you bring us out here? They're getting hungry. At least back in Egypt we had something to eat. They're getting thirsty again. They're wanting to go back. They're wanting to turn around. They're wanting to go the opposite direction that this cloud is leading them. They're wanting to be disobedient. They're becoming discouraged. They're complaining, and they're wanting to quit. God knows the heart of His people. And as He's setting up for the very first time a people that are separated unto their God with this huge commission that's been given by God, He wants to impress them with one thing. You are My people with a very big purpose. And you can only accomplish your very big purpose if you have a very big view of your very big God. Words don't matter. What matters is your heart. What matters is how big I'm printed on your heart. And so He's going to take the time to bring them to the mountain and do everything that He's about to do. The second truth that emerges from this text is this. God expects His people to prepare to meet with their God. When you look at the words that are just laid out there for us in this text, verse 9, "Behold," God says, "Moses, I am coming to you." Just let that sink in for a minute. You're out at Costco this week. You're in your van driving this week. You're doing whatever you're doing this week. And all of a sudden you get this message from God. "Yo, Jeff, I am coming to you." You think you'd pull over? You'd think you'd stop and think about that a couple times? Wait a minute. Who's God? God. Oh, just God. Oh, keep on going. Wait a minute. Here's a message from the one who spoke the stars into existence. The whole universe in just a sentence. Boom. Let there be the stars. He made them too. And he's making an appointment in his daytimer with who? Me? Look down at verse 11. He says, "Be ready for the third day, for on the third day the Lord will come down." God wants to meet with you. God wants a personal appointment with you. Wow. So he says, "I'm going to come down to you." Verse 13, the people will come up. They're going to come up to the foot of this mountain. They're all going to stand close, and they're all going to gaze up. He's going to put them in the position where they have to look up upon their God. They won't see his form. They'll see a fire. But as he calls them to this place, verse 10, he tells Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them. Consecrate them today. Consecrate them tomorrow." We don't know exactly what Moses did in order to consecrate them, but we know that sacrifice has been a part of the consecration process, even back all the way to the Exodus, where on the night before the Passover, they consecrated all of the firstborns by means of sacrifice, where death stood in for life. And so, we don't know for sure, but probably Moses, in his intercessory and mediary role, goes down and consecrates the people. God tells them furthermore in verse 10 to wash their garments. Washing would have ceremonial rites, would have ceremonial practice and symbolic meaning. But the idea there is putting off that which defiles. And the word garments here is the same word that was used of the garments that they took from their Egyptian neighbors. So perhaps these are still Egyptian garments that they're wearing. God says, "Moses, tell the people that as they come to me, that there needs to be a purity about them. There needs to be a separation from that which is common, that which is defiling, that which is their past. Because we're coming to a brand new moment. The moment where I am meeting with my people." He tells them down in verse 11 to be ready for the third day. That means they're going to have to wait. Today is the first day. So Moses, go down on this day, consecrate them. Tomorrow, consecrate them. And on the third day, I'm going to show up. So he does that. They go down. They start to get ready. They start to wash their clothes. They start to take their baths. They've been wandering around for 3 months. They're starting to get themselves cleaned up. Verse 12, he says, "I want you to set limits. Set limits for the people all around this mountain. Take care that they don't go up into it. They don't touch the edge of it. Anything or anyone who touches the mountain shall be put to death. Whether it's a man or a beast, he must die." God says, "Moses, get ready now, for on the third day I'm coming. And as you go down, tell everybody to start preparing for this event that's going to happen, where they are going to meet with me, I am going to meet with them. And I want you to take this periphery of the mountain, and I want you to set up a barrier, set up a boundary. Don't let people pass it." Boy, I can imagine if I were Moses, I would go down and that would be like the first thing I would work on. I'd start getting out the police tape, "Do not cross, danger zone," stretching out the yellow tape, making sure that everybody sees, everybody knows. But I can imagine, if I was a mom, if I was a dad, where's Caleb? "I don't know, I thought you had him." "I didn't have him, I thought you had him." "Where's Caleb?" "For the next day and a half, you're running outside." "He's not by the mountain, is he?" "Steve, you just got some new sheep yesterday. They don't know where they fit yet on the farm." "Hey, where's the sheep?" "I don't know. Didn't you lock the pen? I thought you locked the pen. Where's the sheep? Are they by the mountain?" For a day and a half, this mountain is looming large. They're thinking about the fact that God is real and he's a deadly reality. Anything that touches that mountain becomes that which touches the holy. It's been separated. It's been made holy. But when that which is defiled touches that which is holy, it's dedicated to God for destruction. And so he says, if somebody touches this mountain, don't you grab them off it. Don't you pull them away from it. You gather around them and you keep your distance, because that now belongs to God. It's entered his presence and it's defiled. And the only way to deal with that is to kill it. It's an amazing thing. Basically, God is telling them this. Folks, you don't just waltz into my presence merrily as you please. In order to approach me, you need to understand that it's a serious, it's a somber, it's a sober thing to enter into my presence. It's a life and death prospect to enter into the presence of the living God. That's why the book of Hebrews says it's a scary thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Even today as Christians, we need to have this understanding that the only reason we enter into God's presence, the only reason we can call upon Jesus as our friend, is because Jesus took the hit. Is because Jesus is the one who had to satisfy the holiness of this austere and unapproachable God, because we are the ones who are defiled. We are the ones who are destined for destruction. And Jesus had to stand in our place so that we can call him Daddy, Father. But sometimes we forget about that part and we just run to the reality. He says, folks, don't forget how big a deal it is. When you come into my presence, I still long for you to be a pure people. I still long for you to put off your sin in order for us to have that fellowship. Is it available? Yes. If we confess our sins, he's faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. But understand, the only way you come into my presence is if you're longing for those sins to be removed so that we can enter and talk together in this realm called holiness. Consecrate, wash, be ready, set limits. Verse 15, he has the instruction not to go near a woman. The idea there is for physical intimacy. And it's not that that is wrong or sinful. It's invented by God. Other places it's called holy. But the idea there, and he doesn't use necessarily the words that we would think he would use at this place. He just says simply, don't go near. Don't give your heart to that which is not wrong, but that which would steal your heart away from me at this moment. I don't know how often it's happened. It happens repeatedly for me every week that I go to spend time with God, and that which is common draws my attention away from God. Not bad, not sinful. It's just as I come to God, I need to on purpose take those things in my life that would take my heart away from God, and I need to put them away for just a little bit, so that I can take time to gaze, like David said, upon the beauty and the bigness of my God. Because if I don't take time to do that, if I don't take time to put off all the other stuff, even good stuff, so that I can fill my heart with God, you know what? My heart's not going to get filled with God. My heart's going to be filled with all the other stuff that fills up my heart on a regular basis. And when my heart is filled, there's no way I can have a big view of my God. A third truth. This transcendent God, this big, huge, unapproachable God, will not go unnoticed when he comes to meet with his people. This is verse 16. The morning of the third day shows up. There's thunders. There's lightnings. There's a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast so that all the people in the camp trembled. You know what? It doesn't say here anything about it, but I'm thinking, how many went out and gathered manna that morning? You know what? Not only did they put off physical intimacy, I'll bet this morning of all mornings, they woke up and said, you know, I'm not hungry today. I'll pass on the manna, Mom, thanks. No manna muffins for me today. Wow. All of a sudden, God shows up. He's there. There's thunders. There's lightnings. God's power shows up. You can't miss it when the thunderstorm happens and it's happening right outside your window. The lightning striking, the thunder's rolling. It gets your attention. It holds your attention. It captivates your attention. God's power holds them transfixed at this moment. It says that there's a thick cloud upon the mountain. Even as God comes in this nearness to His people, He's shrouded in mystery. There's this getting close, and yet there's this giving, but there's still this mystery of who this God is. There's a trumpet. And we find that as the story progresses that this trumpet is blowing loud. It's a loud trumpet to start out with. It's probably the shofar, a ram's horn, what would be used for announcing the coming of the king. And it starts softly. And you can picture what's happening as this smoke descends. Some have tried to confuse this and say that this is probably a volcano out in the desert, and there's smoke because it's a volcano. It doesn't say that the fire came up. It says the fire came down and settled on this mountain. That's an inverted volcano. God is coming, and this horn is sounding as the King of Kings is coming near, and the closer He comes, the louder it gets, announcing the presence of the King. You know, we have, probably not us, because we've come to that place where we've gotten on our knees before this transcendent God, this holy God. But we've worked with, we've walked alongside, we've been friends and neighbors with those who just kind of have this view of God as the big buddy upstairs, the big man in the clouds, if you will. And they joke that, you know, you need to be ready for when He comes. You know, when He comes, we'll buy Him a beer. We'll ask Him to join our party. Wow. A blasphemous view, a familiar view of this God who's shrouded with holiness and mystery. And as He comes, it says the people themselves tremble, but not just the people. It says, just a little bit farther, it says that the mountain itself was trembling. There's an earthquake. As even the elements of earth start to shake in the midst of God's magisterial presence. There's smoke. There's fire, indicating God's holiness and God's judgment. This is an amazing scene. I love the book of Revelation, chapter 1, verse 7, where John says, "May you be blessed in Jesus Christ, the one who's coming, and in His coming, every eye will see Him." There's coming a day. This is just a story for us in the past, but it's for our benefit. But there's coming a day again when Jesus Christ is coming back, and there's not an eye that will miss Him. There's going to be a trumpet. There's going to be thunders. There's going to be lightnings. And Jesus Christ is going to come in all of His glory, and this time not for salvation, but for judgment upon planet Earth. Go to Psalm 50 for just a second. Psalm 50, verses 1 through 6. The Mighty One, God, Yahweh, speaks and summons the entire earth from the rising of the sun to the setting of the sun. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God shines forth. Our God comes. He does not keep silence. Before Him is this devouring fire. Around Him is a mighty tempest. He calls to the heaven above. He calls to the earth that He may judge His people. Gather to me my faithful ones who've made covenant with me by sacrifice. The heavens declare His righteousness. God Himself is judge. In this context, God is judging his own people first. That's what happens at the end of the story. That's why Jesus says, listen, live ready. Because I'm coming back first for my people, I'm going to evaluate my people. If I lose sight of God as big, as holy, and myself as small and sinful, I'll not be ready for when he comes for me. Finally, a careless people require repeated warnings and a divinely appointed mediator. Verse 20, the Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain. The Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. The Lord tells Moses, go down and warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to look, and many of them perish. Also tell the priests who do come near to the Lord to consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. Moses said to the Lord, come on, God, the people already can't come up to the mountain. You've already told us, you've already warned us to set these limits around the mountain. The Lord said to him, Moses, go back down. Then come back up bringing Aaron with you, but don't let the priests or the people break through to come up to me. Because if they break through, I'll break out against them. So Moses goes back down the mountain. If in this chapter, Moses is going up and down and up and down and up and down. He goes up and down three times. There's going to be seven times before this he's done with all of this. Going up the mountain, coming down the mountain, going up the mountain, going down the mountain. Would you want to go up on that mountain? Whew, not me. Moses can only go up there because he's the divinely appointed mediator. Aren't you thankful? When Paul tells Timothy, Timothy, there's one God and men. And there's the man Christ Jesus, the one who's the appointed mediator, the one who's the go-between, this holy God and sinful man. But God says, Moses, I know what I've said. But even with all of this, I know the heart of man. I know that he has this desire, even in the midst of all of this supernatural phenomenon, that there's this place in the heart of man that just wants to pull back the curtain and get a corner of God for himself. Man doesn't want me for who I am. Man wants me for what man can do with me. Man wants me so that he can manipulate me, so he can have me, so he can corner me, so he can look at me in a voyeuristic fashion. I'm not that kind of God that I will be used. I'm a God who presents himself to his people so that they can gaze upon me, but I want them to see me for who I am. I will give myself to them and I will give much to them. But there's some parts of me, Moses, they can never have access to. Even when Moses says, God, show me more of your glory. God says, Moses, in order for me to do that, I've got to stick you in the rock. I've got to cover you with my hand because I'm too much for you. Don't let them look upon me. We don't know who these priests are at the time. The priests don't come into office until later in the story. Perhaps it's the firstborns who are functioning as priests within their homes. Perhaps it's the fathers. But the idea here is those who routinely represent me to their families and their families to me, don't let them be presumptuous at this point. Don't let them think that they can just throw their backpack on and truck up the mountain because they're used to coming. Listen, this is something entirely different. I want them to get a large view of me. I don't want them to think that they have this hunky-dory access, this trite access to my presence, where they can throw off their cares, they can throw off their concerns and just waltz into my presence. I don't want them breaking through my barriers. Because if they break through without taking me seriously, I must break out against them. God says, don't let them be presumptuous, Moses. And I'm repeating it again because it bears repeating. Because if you don't warn them, this is what will happen. Moses, you have to go back down and tell them because only one can come up here. And then I want you to bring up Aaron because he will be my high priest. I want you to bring him in this mediatorial role. It's an amazing thing. when God brings them to the mount, He brings them to Mount Sinai. It's a scary place. But we read earlier today that God has brought us not to Sinai, but to Zion. They're both covenant places. In Mount Sinai, it's on earth. It's real, but it's not ultimate. Mount Zion is in heaven. It's real and it's ultimate. Mount Sinai is a place of fear with smoke and thunder. Mount Zion is a place of joy and festal gathering. Mount Sinai is a place in the wilderness with darkness, gloom, and Moses alone is allowed access. But Mount Zion is the place of community, a city with angels, God, Jesus, and righteous souls. Mount Sinai is a place of insecurity. Mount Zion is a place of security. Security. There, our status has been secured in Jesus. Mount Sinai is a place where the law is carved in stone. Mount Zion is the place where grace has been written in blood. What an amazing contrast, as Mount Sinai is the place of judgment, designed to reveal their failure in giving out the law, to showcase and reveal their sin. But Mount Zion is that place of justification, designed to bring us unto perfection with God. Mount Sinai, a place of death. Touching the mountain results in the overwhelming dissonance of God's holiness and my sinfulness. The place of Mount Zion is a place of life, an overwhelming harmony with the holiness of God. What a difference! But it still comes at the price of Jesus Christ. You know what? God's people are powered by a powerful view of their God. That's why when we come together, the most important thing we can do is to worship. If we worship well, we will be giving our eyes a larger view of God. We'll be giving our heart a bigger thirst for God. I don't know how you get ready for Sundays, but if you don't take any time to prepare for God to speak to you, for God to have your heart on a Sunday morning, let me encourage you to take some time to do that, to put other things aside. And it's not just Sundays. I don't know how you take time for that quiet time throughout the week. If you try to have your devotions in front of the television, I'll tell you what, that's not going to work so very well. I guarantee it. If you try to have your devotions on the way to work, on your drive time, it's. If you try to slip God in, you know what? That's not really making God God. And you wonder why you have an anemic Christian life? You wonder why people aren't getting saved? You wonder why you don't have a thirst for holiness? You know what? It might be because your view of God is small. What's your view of God this morning?